Okay, good morning everyone. Welcome to Kadampa Center. Okay, so we'll begin with our prayers on the beige page in the prayer book. We'll do Shakyamuni Buddha's mantra three times, four immeasurables in English, and then chant it in Tibetan. Down at the bottom of the page, we'll do refuge in bodhicitta three times. And then on the back of the page, we'll do the seven-limb prayer and the first verse of the short mandala offering, all in English. Okay? Tayata Om Mune Mune Maha Munaye Soha Tayata Om Mune Mune Maha Munaye Soha Tayata Om Mune Maha Munaye Soha. May all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all sentient beings be free from suffering, the causes of suffering. May all sentient beings be inseparable from the happiness that is free from suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. Sentientam chede wandang dewe gyurdam denpa gyurshik duge dandu Gelgi Gyurda Drelwe Gyursi Dugel Mepe Dewa Dami Drelwe Gyursi Nere chavdan nidan drelwe tamnyam lane pargyushing. Now we'll recite refuge in bodhicitta three times. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. Then on the top of the back of that page, we'll read the seven-limb prayer. Reverently I prostrate with my body, speech, and mind. I present clouds of every type of offering, actual and imagined. I declare all my negative actions accumulate since beginningless time, and rejoice in the merit of all holy and ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of cyclic existence and turn the wheel of Dharma for living beings. I dedicate my own merits and those of all others to the great enlightenment. And then we'll do the first verse of the short mandala offering in English. This ground anointed with perfume, strewn with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, four continents, the sun and the moon. I imagine this as a Buddha field and offer it. May all living beings enjoy this pure land. Idam Guru Ratna Mandala Kam Niryatayami. So the young people may go to their classes. Oh, do we want to do some chants? You want to do some omanis? Oh, come on back. Okay. How many Omanis do you want to do?
Eight Omani and seven.
Oh, you want to do those now? Okay. Okay, so we'll do 8 Omani Padme Ums and 7 Tara chants, okay? Omani Padme Hum, 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 Omani Padme Hum. Om Tare Tu Re Soha. 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 Om Tare Tu Tu Re Soha. Om Tare Tu Re Soha. Okay, Nadia, thank you. Okay, and if your child is here for the first time, could you please accompany them this morning? Thank you. Oh, more room in here now. Okay. Thank you. Let me just get a feel for who's here today. Do we have anyone who's here for the very first time today? A couple of people. Okay, great. Glad to have you here. Everybody else is a very experienced Buddhism, and they've been meditating for years and years and years. So don't be intimidated by them. My name's Robbie Watkins. I've been a member of Kadampa Center for about 20 years. And Geshe Gelug, our resident teacher, is away for several months. He's visiting other centers in the FPMT, the organization that we're part of around the world, and recharging his batteries. And in 2 weeks, we'll have Venerable George Chernoff, one of the senior most Western monks in our organization, will be here for 6 weeks, and he'll be leading the Sunday sessions. So in between, we've had kind of potluck, and today Sarah's scraping the bottom of the pot, and she told me I was going to be up here. So I'll be leading the discussion this morning. But we'll begin with some meditation. So, when we meditate, first thing is always to check our posture, whether we're sitting on a cushion or in a chair. The most important aspect of the posture is that our back is a little bit straighter than we normally sit. It's not rigid, but a little bit straighter. Our head is straight on our shoulders. Maybe just a couple degrees in front of the vertical, but not asleep on our chest. Our eyes are either lightly closed or just slightly open, letting in a little bit of light. Our lips are lightly closed. Our jaw is not clenched. The tongue is on the gum above the upper teeth. Our shoulders are down and back a little bit, so that our chest is open. Our arms are away from the sides of our torso. And it's perfectly okay to sit with our hands on our knees, or we can put our right hand on left with our thumbs touching slightly below the level of our navel. Our legs are in a position that we find stable and comfortable. If we're sitting in a chair, it's perfectly okay to put a cushion under your feet. And if you're on a cushion, it's good to sit towards the front third of the cushion and get your knees down towards the cushion if you can. The point of the posture is not to torture yourself or to be uncomfortable, but to establish a posture that is stable and maintains itself so that during the meditation that's going to follow, it doesn't become a source of distraction. If you find during the meditation you're always thinking about your posture, you probably need to modify something and find something that works for you. One of the most important aspects of the posture is that it opens up the energy channels that flow from our head down to the level of our genitalia in front of the spine. So that's why we want the back up and open. Sometimes it's referred to as a regal posture. But it's one where we also feel very grounded. It's a very solid and self-maintaining posture. So go ahead and just check your posture first. And we'll begin our meditation by doing a version of what's called 9-round breathing that just helps settle the mind. There are many versions of this. Geshe-la teaches one on Sunday morning. The one I like to use is very simple. Close the left nostril, take 3 breaths in and out through the right nostril. Close the right nostril, take 3 breaths in and out through the left nostril. Open both nostrils, 3 breaths in and out. The stomach expands on the in-breath, so our diaphragm is being pulled down and our lungs are completely filling. And then it contracts towards the spine on the out-breath. So really deep breaths for a total of 9 breaths, and you can do that at your own pace. And now we allow our breath to return to its normal pattern. And always, we begin our meditation by setting our motivation. What is my reason for being here at Kadampa Center this morning? Doing this meditation and participating in the discussion to follow. And whatever brought us here this morning is a valid motivation. If we came just out of curiosity, that's fine. If we came because we just want a little peace and quiet during a hectic weekend, that's great. If we came because this makes a positive imprint on our mind, fantastic. But the Buddha told us that the highest motivation, the most powerful motivation, is what's referred to as the bodhicitta motivation. The motivation that everything I think, everything I say, everything I do is done so that I can be of more benefit to others. Everything. Even something as simple as sitting on a cushion for 20 minutes. Done so I can benefit others. For most of us, that's not a natural way of thinking. It seems almost grandiose. But even effortfully forcing ourselves to think in that way is incredibly powerful. We just grit our teeth and force out a little bit of bodhicitta. Fantastic. So let's just sit for a minute and generate the bodhicitta motivation. And having set our motivation, we now begin the actual meditation practice. We're going to do a very simple concentration meditation. For all of us, our mind has some ability to concentrate, though it's not really a quality that we've developed over the years. So when we meditate, we choose an object for the meditation. What is my mind going to pay attention to? And we don't just sit and let our mind wander from one pleasant thought to another. We have a chosen object, and we place our mind on that object. So in this meditation, the object is the breath, just the physical sensation of the breath moving in and out through our nostrils. We place our mind on that, mind on the breath, nothing more, nothing less than that. Every time the mind wanders, as it inevitably will, off to something I need to do when I leave the center, or something I need to get ready for work tomorrow, or something fun I did yesterday, we just set that aside. We don't get harsh with ourselves. We know that's inevitable. Set that aside. Come back to the breath. Over and over and over and over again. And that's the meditation. And we can end our meditation, as always, by doing a dedication. Acknowledge that by sitting quietly and becoming familiar with our mind in this way, we've done something a little out of the ordinary. Something that, even if it seemed difficult or awkward, made a positive imprint on our mind stream. And now we think, may that positive imprint not be lost, but may it ripen at a future time in a way that is of benefit to all sentient beings. Any questions or comments about the meditation we just did? Everybody is very, very quiet. I think we do have a bunch of experienced meditators here this morning. This is going to be a discussion today. If there's no discussion, we get out early. So it's up to you. We do have several million people around the world who are streaming this live, so wait till you get the mic before you talk, okay? The mic is the talking stick. There are at least one or two people who are tuning in, so they do like to hear the comments from the group. How many people were here 2 weeks ago when Don Brown led the discussion on things I hate about Tibetan Buddhism? Okay. Well, they came up with a very long list. They wanted to go into overtime, but Don wouldn't let them. So today we're doing the flip side, things I like about Tibetan Buddhism. And this is going to be an open discussion. Everybody here had the opportunity to do many things this morning, but for some reason you decided to come to Kadampa Center. And what we'd like to do is hear some of the reasons, what attracts you about this tradition. Do we have anyone here who was raised a Buddhist? Okay, so every single person in this room came from a different tradition. That's interesting, isn't it? Yeah. Things I heart. And we're going to say, we'll assume Tibetan, but any type of Buddhism. Some of us are card-carrying Buddhists. Some people find it interesting. Some people are here out of curiosity. So everything is it's open season here. Anything you want to list is good. The first group came up with a great list, so I'm going to be comparing your list to theirs mentally in my mind. But I was very disappointed that no one said Kadampa Center's director. I thought that would be at least in the top three. Okay, so I'm just going to throw it out to the crowd. Yeah, wait for the talking stick. Yeah, and we'll just list a bunch of things, and then we'll go, as time allows, go back and talk about some of them. Okay, this is David Strievel, who 2 weeks ago admitted what he didn't like. It was very, very honest and open sharing about what he did not find useful about Tibetan Buddhism. So I'm glad you're talking, Dave. Thank you.
So I would like to, to me, one of the most remarkable differences about the Buddhist tradition is that it's full of practical instructions of what to think about human existence and how to think about it and how to face life positively, which is really missing from the other traditions that I used to be part of. And to me, that's a very valuable part of it, to think about, you know, life's difficulties. We admit that there are many but that we have a way of thinking about them and acting that helps us make the best of it.
Okay, so I'm going to try and summarize that as practical instructions about life. Does that sum up what you were saying, Dave? Okay, with the emphasis being on practical, right? Okay, great. Okay, over here, Royden.
So one of the things that I truly cherish about the Kadampa Center in Tibetan Buddhism is its respect for where everybody came from and where everybody is right now.
Mm-hmm.
When I give the newcomer orientation, I can truly say that everyone is welcome here, no matter what their background or current beliefs, and the mission is pretty obvious and does not include...
Okay.
Yep.
So, respect. Welcome for all. Does that express what you were saying?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Okay, someone else. Yeah.
And as like, I guess a side part of that, I really appreciate the community that we've been able to build here.
Okay.
I've been in other, even Tibetan traditions, and I feel like a lot of it is more emphasizing on practice as a personal matter rather than as a community. So.
Okay. Okay. Dorothy?
What I really liked about it is how it investigates. Like, if you don't understand something, like I grew up Christian, so you had to just believe blindly. Here, I can investigate whether or not it's true, investigate reality, and come to my own conclusions, and see whether or not Buddha challenges us to challenge him.
Okay.
And I like that.
Yeah, the Buddha said, you know, take my teachings and test them against your own experience. So I think there are a lot of people who come from a scientific background who find that aspect of Buddhism very appealing. So investigate, test, everything. Don't take anything the Buddha said just because he said it. Or any other teacher, okay? Yeah, this attitude, you know, it didn't die out with the Buddha. We should bring that attitude towards all teachings that we receive. Okay. Yeah, over here.
All right. It's kind of along the same way of what Dorothy said there, but it's kind of made me, I guess not made, but helped me investigate the interconnectivity of a lot of things, especially on, I guess, the spiritual/faith side of life, and seeing how things really are interconnected, and you know, the true histories and things of that nature.
Okay, yeah, the term we use for that in Buddhism is interdependence. How everything is interdependent. So you appreciate that interdependence. Okay. Let's see. Over here, let's see. Wait, we got someone in the back. Okay.
Yeah. I really like how it has the ability to be versatile in its applicability, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, you can be super spiritual. You can be just like, oh, I'm going to go because I'm feeling really down and I want something to help, you know?
Yeah.
Like, you don't have to treat it exactly like a religion. Like, Buddha had a strong desire for that, for it to be, like, open for many different types of people and how they wanted to practice it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, yeah. Yeah, we had somebody mention something like that in the first session. They said, it's perfectly okay to pick and choose. You know, this I find this useful. I don't find that useful. I'll take this. Let's see, how would I... how do you want me to put that down here? How can you sum that up?
Versatility, I guess.
Versatility, okay. It's different things for different people. Yeah. For the super spiritual, as you put it. Who here qualifies as super spiritual? Okay.
The Sangha for lighting the path, showing the path and the way.
Okay.
And can we get the director on the board?
No. No. We're talking about Buddhism in general, not about Kadampa Center.
Okay.
Okay? Yeah. The director on the board. Okay. No, I won't fit up there. Okay. Okay. So the Sangha. Yeah. That's, you know, that's something in most spiritual traditions in the West. You don't have robe monks and nuns. In Catholicism you do, but certainly not in most of the Protestant traditions. And it's an incredible inspiration for most of us. Yeah. Annie?
I love the altar. I love all the statues, and I love the rituals, and I love all the ceremonies.
Well, that was on the thing, the list people of things didn't like two weeks ago.
For some people, but I'm fascinated by it, and I think it brings, like, a rich tradition to the practice.
So, altar, rituals, iconography. You must have been Tibetan in your previous lifetime, yeah. Iconography. Okay, great. Keep going.
So, right here.
Yeah.
So, actually, one of the things that I disliked most about Tibetan Buddhism in the beginning was all the iconography that now, I guess, has come flip side of it. And besides the any sentimentalness for particular altars or images, now it has become very apparent to me what phenomenal tools they are, even if you become disenfranchised with any emotional feeling towards them, what phenomenal tools they are for exercising different parts of your brain. So the different visualizations that you walk through, that it's just had so many generations of compounding to exercise different parts of your brain or different compassions or long life or well wishes for other people that... They're phenomenal tools, even if you just objectively look at them.
Yeah,
and that's become the thing. One of the things that I like most about all the icons and images.
Okay, so that involves learning what they're about rather than just looking at them and being freaked out by all this bizarreness. Yeah, so but as mental tools. Yeah.
I just wanted to say, along with this train of thought about the beauty of everything around us, I really love the altar. I love these hangings, and I don't know all the meanings, but it's just really beautiful. And as an artist, I can really appreciate it. And then just, I watched a Tibetan ritual with the mandalas, with the sand, and it was so... wonderful just to watch them doing something so beautiful and so skilled for a spiritual purpose. I really appreciated that.
Okay, so mental tools, but also their beauty. Okay.
Thank you. It makes me happy. And it makes me happy.
Okay.
And it doesn't. And it wants me to be happy instead of guilty, nervous, oppressed. It's like whenever I'm here or whenever I practice, I feel this community. Everyone wants me to be happy, and I want everyone to be happy. And when I leave, I'm a lot happier.
Uh-huh. Okay. Okay, happy, not guilty. Yeah. Okay.
I got another one.
Okay.
I got lots of them, but I'll let people take turns. My second one that I really liked, which is maybe one that people hated, was the history. The fact that the Sangha have constantly repeated it over and over and over and memorized it for millennia, and it's not like this fly-by tradition that just started.
Okay.
It's been here a really long time, and so to me it gave it some validity because of the history.
Okay. Can I say lineage? Is that okay? That it's been passed down from person to person without gaps, frequently just passed down orally and then writing, and now On the internet, yeah, okay.
Hi, this is my first time here, and my name is Pavitra.
Welcome.
Thank you. And what I like about Buddhism is how much it's based on psychotherapy. Like, it's based on the power of now. And if you ask me now, right now, I don't have any problem. How
mm-hmm.
it conditions me to be a better person and serving others.
Mm-hmm.
Because if I follow the rules properly, I think I will have a better life.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So it really helps me. It answers the questions which I thought were unanswerable, but it does help.
Okay, so saying that it's based on the mind,
yes.
is that okay? Psychology, okay. Okay, great. Let's just take a couple more, and then we'll look at a few of these as time allows.
I like it because you don't see Buddhists trying to convert everybody in the world. And to me, that's refreshing. They're not knocking on your door and trying to make you believe. It's your choice.
Okay. Non-proselytizing. Yeah, that's not proselytizing. I don't know how to spell it. Yeah. Okay. Next. Let's see.
It's here.
Okay.
I feel that it's also very empowering.
Mm-hmm.
Because it uses a lot of common sense. Mm. And then make you are responsible for your life to be better, not some magical power or something.
Uh-huh.
Or a prayer that's going to make you gain,
uh-huh.
make more money. Or
okay.
It's very empowering to.
Okay, so we'll say empowering. Oops.
Accountable, yeah. It makes you accountable to that.
Yeah, that's what's going on. Mm-hmm. Personal responsibility. Yep, it's all up to you.
That's all I was going to say.
Which some people like, other people don't like, yeah. Okay, let's get a couple more.
I enjoy how your own personal benefit is also seen as benefit to the people around you.
Mm-hmm.
It gives the philosophy that if you're happy, you're going to be able to make other people happy,
mm-hmm.
regardless of whether they practice with you.
Yeah, okay.
It spreads, and
okay.
I enjoy that kind of thinking.
Okay, personal, yeah. Like they say, the best thing you can do for other people is to get your own act together. Personal happiness benefits others.
Exactly.
Okay, a couple more.
At the risk of offending some people.
things we like, not about things we don't like. Yeah,
I know. This is the context of this is somebody was telling me the other day. Well, let me have a sidebar about real quick about community. I just read an article in a medical journal that people in their midlife that have a spiritual connection and have a large community of people have a much lower instance of suicide. I thought that was important.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the point I wanted to make was I think Buddhism has great potential for healing the mind. Now, you could put purification, because I think that's the process of purification allows for this healing to take place.
Mm-hmm.
I think they're sort of synonymous. And then one more slash would be something that those of us from the Christian tradition might experience, because this person was saying, well, I don't like Buddhism because there's no redemption in Buddhism. You know, like you say, okay, I'm saved, therefore I'm completely liberated and am going to heaven. I'm, you know, straight shot. And I sort of disagree with that. I really think that this healing and purification that we can do, if the experience of redemption is like freedom and letting go and feeling like very optimistic and positive, I think that's exactly what happens when we really practice Buddhism and purification. There is a feeling of being free. you know, you were talking about happiness, call it what you want to, but it is something that we do ourselves. We generate it ourselves. It's not coming from some supreme being. This is something that we can, we're responsible, again, right back to the notion of responsibility.
Okay, there's a lot in that. Yeah, Chrissy, yeah. Okay, people won't keep adding to the list. I wanted to talk about some of them, but let's keep going on the list. It's fun to hear these things.
This kind of goes under that healing, mind purification, and then also using the altars and the iconography as tools. But using some of the wrathful deities for me have been really powerful. Mm. And I was turned off of them, obviously, at the beginning because they're not from my tradition. And I'm like, how is this? Is it okay to feel these things? Is it okay to see them as reality? And I think that's something that Tibetan Buddhism does really well, is that nothing is off the table. Everything is up for discussion. Mm-hmm. You know, and even these things that you've been taught maybe in your past that we shouldn't talk about these things, we shouldn't think of these things. If you think of these things, then, you know, there's something wrong with you. And to have deities that mm-hmm. I can use to explore these mm-hmm. ideas and thoughts and emotions that go through me, either for healing or purification, has really been something that I really like about Tibetan Buddhism.
Okay. Yeah. I think that's an interesting point. I mean, all aspects of our life are included somewhere. You know, sex is, the sexual aspect is very prominent. You know, using wrath, using desire. You know, it's not like you have to pretend those aren't there or push them under the table. You know, there's ways that they can be used as part of your spiritual practice, which I do think, to me, seems kind of unique. I don't know. I haven't done comparative religions, but that's a very interesting point. Okay, Lisa.
I like the Buddhist take on death and how it encourages you to
talk about death, suffering.
Speaking
yeah.
from personal
Love
experience
it.
Of someone who's thought about it in a very negative way at some point in my life, I like to think of it positively now and use it as a tool.
Yeah. So tell me a little bit more, what about the Buddhist teachings on death? Are you
encourages you to think about your own life.
Okay.
And death is an inevitable part of it. And it's something that we don't need to be afraid of. It is what it is.
Yeah.
We need to accept it, embrace it even.
Death meditations and preparation. Joey.
I like the fact that there's like a method for almost any problem we got.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't say I've explored every method, but
yeah.
you know, it's nice to know that if there is a problem I have, that there's
yeah.
a method for it.
I think that's what Dave was talking about in number one, yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's something I appreciate. You know, somewhere you're going to find if something's going wrong, you can find an explanation, what's causing it, what you need to do about it, what the consequences are. So it's very practical and all-inclusive. Okay.
I like the focus on compassion, and I feel that...
That was the first one that came up in the other class. Yeah. I'm not saying... Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I feel the open hearts when I'm here.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. Yeah, let's make this the last one or next to last one.
This might touch a little bit on a lot of the other ones, but I find that a lot that people that are studying Buddhism tend to like walk the walk and talk the talk in other areas of their life. Like they don't go to work and they're like cutthroat to everybody. Like it really kind of spreads, I think,
mm-hmm.
to almost everything you do. Where it's not like for 1 hour when I come to the center, you know, I'm peaceful with everybody. But then as soon as I walk out, I'm cutting everybody
uh-huh.
off. So I try to get to the grocery store. It's
uh-huh.
You know, it's kind of, it's very pervasive. And it
yeah,
to be pervasive
pervades everyday life. Pervades daily life. I mean, this is an example. If you study karma and really believe it, you know, it's in the back of your mind. You know, you'll never let anyone give you excess change at the grocery store ever again. Yeah. Okay.
I got a quick one for completeness.
Okay.
And try just to get myself into the discussion is that emptiness and impermanence, put that up there.
Emptiness and impermanence. Well, we've got compassion, we've got emptiness, so we've got everything up here, yeah. These are two terms that people may not be familiar with. If you're new to Kadampa Center or Tibetan Buddhism, do you want to explain them, Chris?
Woohoo, Mr. DeMille, I'm ready for my close-up. Emptiness is the fact that everything that we think is solid and impermanent or permanent really is made up of parts and causes and conditions in our perceiving mind. And I'll leave it at that. And then,
as Don explained a couple of weeks ago, it means none of us are seeing the same thing. There is not anything that exists out there such that Chris and I are going to see it in the exactly same way. Our mind is influencing, we can even say, creating what we see, what our experience is. Okay, go ahead.
And then impermanence is the idea that everything changes moment to moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Physically, mentally, emotionally, our mind, our body are constantly changing. We go through our lives typically with an attitude that I'm this way and I'm fixed. And I may change just a little bit. You know, I may be a little bit nicer some days. I may be a little bit grumpier. But the Buddha says everything is in a state of flux. And our projection that things exist permanently, i.e. in an unchanging way, is a source of a lot of problems. Okay, I'm going to cut the list off there so we can go back and... So we can go back and just talk about a few of these. I want to go back to the first one. I think this is a great one. The practical instructions that we find in Buddhism about life's ups and downs. Dave, you want to elaborate on that a little bit more? To start off the discussion on that one? Yeah.
So to me, what that means is if I think about my boyhood as a Methodist kid.
Now, the point of this discussion is not to slam other religions, okay?
No,
be very careful about that.
I'm not doing that, but, as I recall my training there, there were the Ten Commandments, which is 10 negative things you aren't supposed to do,
mm-hmm.
and mixed with a few you are. And then there's maybe the Golden Rule, but compared to what I learned there, Buddhism has like a zillion times more aspects to it and instructions for
and more lists.
All kinds of situations, all kinds of lists, and and it focuses far more on telling you to look inside your own head to think about how you are perceiving things, asking whether that's real or whether it really needs to be that way, and maybe instructions about how to transform many mm-hmm. of those negative thoughts into positive ones and face life in a better way, both in your own head and in your relations to others, to make things come out a lot more positively. So that's what I mean by a whole lot of practical mm-hmm. instructions about how to face all of life's situations.
Okay. Any comments on that? Yeah. Okay, Royden.
So I think the practical aspect of the list is actually included in the list because as a scientist, one of the first things that I have looked at is you know, how the teachings and how I've taken in some of these things and just look at other people around me and see if that relationship has benefited or if it has benefited those who I feel most attached to,
mm-hmm.
so to say. So I think the practical instruction for me is to be able to look at Layla or whoever and say, is this person that I love or have trouble with benefiting from the things that I'm hearing and taking away from Kadampa Center mm-hmm. Tibetan Buddhism?
Okay. Yeah. Anyone else? Up here in front.
for me, when I think of practical instructions, I think of tools, like a toolkit, and it's very similar to psychology and what they teach there as far as coping mechanisms and focusing on the positive, and it actually kind of gives you a little toolkit that you can put in a box and you can pick and choose what you need during certain events that arise.
Yeah. Yeah, I like that, the toolkit. That's an image that's used a lot. And, you know, okay, I'm getting angry. What do I do to deal with the anger? I open up my toolkit and I can say, well, this person's doing this because they're under the effect of their karma. It's their karma that's forcing them to do this. They're doing this because they want to be happy, but they're just doing it in an unskillful way. Why are they doing it to me? Because it's my karma, okay? But they're just like me. They want to be happy just the way that I do. Okay, so that's one tool you can pull out. Then you can pull out the thought transformation tools where you can actually work on changing the anger into something better. And then if you want to reach down to the bottom of the box, you can pull out your emptiness tools and say, whoa, you know, the things aren't the way I perceive them. You know, they're different levels of tool, different. Some of them you need a little bit more training to use necessarily, but that's a great image. Yeah.
And I was going to say, as part of that toolkit, one of the things that I've gotten over and over again from this center is that a lot of the things that I think are really important problems are not. And so, you know, I'll be struggling with something, and then I'll come here, and then the temple will say, hey, that's samsara. I'll be like, all right.
Yeah.
Yeah, all right. That's no problem.
All right. Okay. Yeah, Dorothy.
What I really like about
Elise, yeah.
Sorry. I really found that it was really helpful to have definitions for things. Over the years, in trying to study different religions and philosophies of life, I decided that there was no one that had all the answers. So I tried to find what was common to all of them. And for one thing, for example, is love and compassion. They all stress love and compassion. But what is love? What is compassion? Mm-hmm. Well, each one of those faith streams would give a lot of examples of amazing people that do things that are loving and compassionate.
Mm-hmm.
But still, like, how do I do those things? How do I get to be the kind of person that does those things?
Yeah.
Well, the first day I was at Kadampa Center, there was that prayer, may all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the definition of love. Wow,
compassion.
There was a definite of compassion,
yeah.
Right? And you know, have happiness, you know, be,
yeah.
And you know, and that was the definition. Well, you know, and then okay, well, happiness is being, or compassion is being free from suffering. Well, what is suffering? Well, suffering is not having a negative mind. Well, what's negative? Well, jealousy, anger. And everything had a definition that then helped me to understand what it was, so then I can work on acquiring it.
Yeah. And not just acquiring it, but we can develop those qualities in our mind. And that's something, you know, I think a lot of us, until we started studying Buddhism, felt we were kind of stuck with the mind we have. I can be a little bit nicer. I can be a little bit this. But the Buddha said, you know, we can develop infinite love, infinite compassion if we follow these methods. It's something that can grow. Okay, great. I want to move on. Did you want to say?
One comment.
Okay, go ahead.
Sorry.
Yeah.
There was one thing. The first time I came here, I came to when Venerable Rabina was teaching. You know, sometimes she rubs people the wrong way, but she's my bodhisattva. And there's something that she said that was the most practical thing in my life that I thought was great, and it's a practical instruction. Zip your lip and keep your hands to yourself. And I have thought about that practically every day because that was one of those that just started, you know, dumping garbage. And to me, she really had some practical tools that were very useful, and I think Buddhism has really given some great instructions for people.
Yeah, yeah, that's a great line. And you know what? You know what the Buddha says: you need to avoid negative actions of thought, speech, and body. Thought is really, really hard. Really. So Venerable Rabina is saying, watch your speech, watch your actions. Zip your lips and keep your hands to yourself. Those we can work on right now in this life, okay? We can't necessarily control our thoughts. Just very brief, we're running out of time. Don, I want to go back to yours. Can you talk a little bit about what you meant by healing in particular? Because that's a word that gets used a lot, but that's a...
Yeah, I don't, you know, it's interesting. We don't talk, it doesn't come up here at the center very often, but when I think about healing, you know, it's kind of a catch, some years ago, and catch term, and yet when it, healing somehow to me means that you don't suffer, you know, somehow the, whatever's got me, maybe it's a memory of something I can, I remember some things that I did in my 20s that I just go, ooh, ouch, I did that. And so those memories still linger, like torment me. And so I've done some practices really working with that to let that go. And so I call letting go of painful memories and painful experiences like that kind of healing. Take place in my mind because I'm not, I don't forget these things, but I'm not run by them like I was. And then,
and maybe explain a little bit about purification for since we have some new people.
Well, you know, purification really has to do with being brutally honest with myself and looking at my life from, you know, who have I done wrong? You know, like that country song. anyway, you know, I think in AA, for example, I actually did this when I did my first experience with Buddhism. I sat down and wrote down the names of everybody I had done wrong that I could think of in this lifetime. And when I got home, I spent hundreds of dollars calling these people, apologizing. They thought I was crazy. But I think that that's part of the purification is acknowledging, first of all, you know, regret that we've done something wrong. Then in Buddhism, we make some kind of declaration that I'm not going to do that again. You know, it's like some, it's not enough to say I'm sorry. You got to say I'm sorry and I'm going to strive not to do that again for a minute, an hour, a day, a year, or the rest of my life. So that part of it's number two. Number three is you take some sort of action. And it might be Vajrasattva mantra. It might be, certainly it would involve, could involve picking up the telephone and apologizing and saying, look, I'm sorry, blah, blah, blah. I'm working on myself and I wasn't then. And I don't want to do that again. And then the fourth one is, we call it taking refuge and generating compassion. But it's really connecting with our spirit, you know, with our spiritual sources of power, which are the three jewels of refuge, and our own ability to develop compassion. So those are the, so the first is regret, and then there's like a declaration that, which is the most important one of all, is to promise not to do it again for some specific period of time. And then there's some action that we take, you know, what do we call it, the remedy. And then refuge in bodhicitta.
Yeah. And Geshe Gelug always says, you get up where you fall down, i.e. saying, don't come to Kadampa Center and do 100 mantras and think you're purifying if you can get on the phone and apologize to the person. You know, if you can, that's much more powerful to actually speak to the person that you've done wrong to.
But I think the end result of it should, you know, if we've done it well, is that whatever, and it's good to try to bring to mind the specific things that we've done that have harmed us and others, but if purification has been done well, then the charge of that negativity may not be completely gone, but it definitely diminishes. And my children actually had this experience on New Year's Eve after doing Dorje Kadra. They go, gosh, I feel so much better after Dorje Kadra. So, anyway, that's purification.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to have to call time there, unfortunately. Thank you, everyone, for your participation. I think you had a longer list than the first group, but there were fewer of them, so I think it comes out even. Let's, on the pink sheet, let's do the verses from Shantideva and then seven green Tara mantras for Geshe Gelug's continued long and healthy life. May all beings everywhere, plagued by sufferings of body and mind, obtain an ocean of happiness and joy by virtue of my merits. May no living creature suffer, commit evil, or ever fall ill. May no one be afraid or belittled with a mind weighed down by depression. May the blind see forms and the deaf hear sounds. May those whose bodies are worn with toil be restored on finding repose. May the naked find clothing and the hungry find food. May the thirsty find water and delicious drinks. May the poor find wealth, those weak with sorrow find joy. May the forlorn find hope, constant happiness and prosperity. May there be timely rains and bountiful harvests. May all medicines be effective and wholesome prayers bear fruit. May all who are sick and ill quickly be freed from their ailments. Whatever diseases there are in the world, may they never occur again. May the frightened cease to be afraid and those bound be freed. May the powerless find power and may people think of benefiting each other. For as long as space remains, for as long as sentient beings remain, until then may I too remain to dispel the miseries of the world. Om tare tu re soha. Om tare tu re soha. Om tare tu re soha. Om tare tu tare tu re soha. Om tare tu re soha. Om tare tu re soha. Om tare tu re soha.